90.5 FM WJFF Jeffersonville, New York, and 94.5 FM W233AH Monticello, New York, hydro-powered, member-supported. Stay tuned. Now and Then is coming right up. Don't forget, tomorrow, Sunday, March 13th, we start daylight savings time, and you're going to need to set your clocks ahead 1 hour. Now and Then is coming right up. Support comes from listeners and from the River Reporter newspaper in Narrowsburg, New York, riverreporter.com. I'm Kathy Geary. Welcome to Now and Then. On today's program, we're going to honor the life, the artistry, the composition, the production of George Martin and the Beatles.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. Now I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. Now I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
Yesterday. That song was written by Paul McCartney and was released in 1965 on the Beatles' Help album. That song was produced by a man named George Martin. George Martin died on Tuesday, March 8th, 2016, at his home in Wiltshire, England. He was 90 years old. George Martin's main claim to fame is as the producer of the Beatles, and from 1962 through 1970, George Martin produced all 13 of the Beatles' albums and 22 singles for the group. Ringo Starr was the one that announced George Martin's passing. He did a Twitter announcement. Paul McCartney also posted a tribute to George Martin, and he talks about what it was like working with George Martin on the song that we just heard called Yesterday. Here's what Paul McCartney has to say. I'm so sad to hear the news of the passing of dear George Martin. I have so many wonderful memories of this great man that will be with me forever. He was a true gentleman and like a second father to me. He guided the career of the Beatles with such skill and good humor that he became a true friend to me and my family. If anyone earned the title of the fifth Beatle, it was George Martin. From the day that he gave the Beatles our first recording contract to the last time I saw him, he was the most generous, intelligent, and musical person I've ever had the pleasure to know. It's hard to choose favorite memories of my time with George. There are so many, but one that comes to mind was the time I brought the song Yesterday to a recording session, and the guys in the band suggested that I sang it solo and accompany myself on guitar. After I had done this, George Martin said to me, "Paul, I have an idea of putting a string quartet on the record." I said, "Oh no, George, we are a rock and roll band, and I don't think that's a good idea." With the gentle bedside manner of a great producer, he said to me, "Let us try it. And if it doesn't work, we won't use it, and we'll go with your solo version." I agreed to this and went round to his house the next day to work on the arrangement. He took my chords that I showed him and spread the notes out across the piano, putting the cello in the low octave and the first violin in a high octave, and gave me my first lesson in how strings were voiced for a quartet. When we recorded the string quartet at Abbey Road, it was so thrilling to know his idea was so correct that I went round telling people about it for weeks. His ideal obviously worked because the song subsequently became one of the most recorded songs ever, with versions by Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, Ray Charles, Marvin Gaye, and thousands more. Well, that was Paul McCartney's tribute to George Martin. George Martin is a really unusual character. Such an interesting life. You know, do you think of him as a producer or as a composer? Was he a businessman first or a musician? Well, he was a little bit of all of those things. George Henry Martin was born in London on January 3rd in 1926. He taught himself to play piano, and he had perfect pitch from the time he was a child. He used to be able to, like, play classical pieces by ear. So when he's in grammar school in England, Bromley Grammar School, and he forms a dance band when he's just a kid, George Martin and the Fortune Tellers. In World War II, he was a pilot in the British Navy with the Fleet Air Arm of the British Navy. And during that time, even though he's in the war, he continues a part-time career as a pianist. He actually gets invited to play one of his compositions on the BBC, on a BBC radio program called Navy Mixture. So when World War II is over, George Martin attends a school of music, the Guildhall School of Music, and he becomes an oboist. So it's interesting that he plays the piano and oboe. They're such different instruments. And while he was at the Guildhall School of Music, he studies composition, he studies conducting, and he continues his study on piano. He actually was a freelance oboist, like a studio musician, and he also worked in the BBC Music Library. So it's interesting that when Parlophone Records hired him in 1955, he's only 29 years old. He's the youngest label manager at EMI. And when George Martin started working at EMI, the idea of a record producer didn't really exist. He kind of brought a definition to what that means, to what that is. And when I think of all the influences that George Martin had on the Beatles, there's a few things that come to mind. And first and foremost for me is the orchestral influence that he had. You know, there is Paul McCartney in a rock and roll band, and they're playing rock and roll. It's kind of like they're playing American blues. It's all electric, you know. There's drums. And in 1965... when they are riding high as a rock and roll band, they record this song Yesterday, and there's not one electric instrument in that song. None of the other Beatles are playing on that song. It's a solo with Paul McCartney, and that entire accompaniment was composed by George Martin. Well, that's not the last time that George does significant composition contributions to the Beatles songs. His influence is on the Beatles, his use of the orchestra. The other thing that he really brought to the Beatles, because of his concepts of composition and arranging, he taught the Beatles about having an introduction and an end to their songs. And when you look at their body of work, that's such a critical part of their song composition style. Also, he taught the Beatles actual studio recording techniques. You know, he was the first of his producer to invite the band into the control room. You know, the control room is separated as a separate room with a glass window, and you watch everybody record, and all the chords come into the mixing board, and you're in a dead sound space so that you can actually hear what's going on in the other room. Well, they would finish recording, and he would invite the Beatles actually into the control room, which was just a completely groundbreaking thing. And he was brilliant at the way he actually recorded. When the Beatles were making these albums, they didn't have multi-track machines. They didn't have digital editing. If they wanted to edit something, they would actually have to get out a razor blade and cut the tape and slice it, paste it together with a cut and paste, literally cut and paste. They would have four tracks. But the most fascinating thing for me is the use of the orchestra in the Beatles songs. And it seems like Paul McCartney was especially influenced by George Martin, because not only did Paul McCartney has a career as a major popular song composer, but he's also written five symphonic pieces. We're going to get into that a little bit later. Yesterday was released in 1965. In the following year, 1966, the Beatles are working on Revolver. And there's a song on that, Eleanor Rigby. And none of the Beatles are playing, like on Yesterday, none of the Beatles are playing any instruments. George Harrison and John Lennon are singing backup vocals. But Eleanor Rigby is accompanied by an octet of string players, four violins, two cellos, and two violas. And it's all a score that was composed by George Martin. So let's listen to Paul McCartney, his composition, Eleanor Rigby, with the string octet recording from the Beatles' Revolver. This is Eleanor Rigby.
I look at all the lovely people. I look at all the lovely people. Eleanor Rigby picks up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for? All the lonely people. Where do they all come from? All the lonely people. Where do they all belong? Father Mackenzie, writing the words of a sermon that no one will hear. No one comes near, look at him working, darning his socks in the night when there's nobody there. What does he care? All the lonely people, where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they all belong? Died in the church and was buried along with her name. Nobody came, Father Mackenzie, wiping the dirt from his hands as he walks from the grave. No one was saved, all the lonely people. Where do they all come from?
That's by the Beatles. From their Revolver album in 1966. George Martin wrote that orchestral accompaniment. He wrote an autobiography called All You Need Is Ears, and he also talks about Eleanor Rigby. And at the very end of the song, you hear, "Oh, look at all the lonely people," being sung contrapuntally over the main lead vocal. And George Martin also says that was his idea. He said he was inspired on the string scoring by Bernard Herrmann. Bernard Herrmann wrote a lot of soundtracks, most notably Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. So the idea that you have a rock and roll band that is willing to add oboe, to add string quartets, to use flutes, this is one of the reasons that the Beatles appealed to such a wide audience outside of just the genre of rock and roll. Was this incredibly what was considered experimental use of instruments. And one of the biggest examples was the end of the Sgt. Pepper's album. There's a song called A Day in the Life. That was a pretty complicated recording. You know, they do all the basic tracks. And we're about to hear it, A Day in the Life. And it's basically two separate songs that are linked together. And so they recorded the songs, and then there's this 23-bar bridge, and they didn't really know what to do with it. So, you know, there's a lot of information on what happens in these things, in these recording sessions. So basically, originally, this transition is just a single piano chord repeated over and over, and one of the engineering assistants, Mal Evans, is counting the bars, 1, 2, 3. And at the end of the 23 bars, they used a ringing alarm clock just to let them know, okay, it's, you know, okay, we're moving on to the next part. But according to George Martin, that they were not able to edit out the alarm clock. And they made the decision to keep the sound in the recording. So McCartney, brings up the idea that why don't they bring in an orchestra to fill this 23-bar middle gap? But he wanted them to improvise. And so he asked George Martin to write a score. So here's what George Martin described that he did in the orchestral part. Quote, "What I did there was to write the lowest possible note for each of the instruments in the orchestra. At the end of the 24 bars, I wrote the highest note, near a chord of E major. Then I put a squiggly line right through the 24 bars with reference points to tell them roughly what note they should have reached during each bar. Of course, they all looked at me as though I were completely mad." Later, Paul McCartney said that the strings were able to keep themselves kind of on schedule, but the trumpets were wild. And he had originally wanted a 90-piece orchestra, but they couldn't, it was just impossible. So what they did is they took that segment that George Martin wrote and they recorded it four times, four different recordings. And they combined them all together in the final orchestral crescendo. The final chord is one of the longest fade outs in pop music. So it ends with Lennon, McCartney, Ringo, and Mal Evans all have three different pianos, and George Martin is on the harmonium, and they all play an E major chord simultaneously. And the final chord was made, they extended it for 40 seconds. As it's fading, they're increasing the recording sound level as the vibration faded out. And towards the end of the chord, the recording level was so high that you can hear other sounds in the studio, like the rustling of papers or a squeaking chair. Anyway, it was a real signature of the Beatles style, and so much of it was influenced by George Martin. Let's hear A Day in the Life. Now you might have a new appreciation for the crazy orchestral ending. From Sgt. Pepper's, this is the Beatles. ¶¶
just had to laugh. I saw the photograph. He blew his mind out in a car. He didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure if he was on the house of love. I saw a film today, oh boy. The English army had just won the war. A crowd of people turned away. But I just had to look. Having read the book, I'd love to turn you
across my head. Found my way downstairs and drank a cup. And looking up, I noticed I was late. Found my coat and grabbed my hat. Made the bus in seconds flat. Found my way upstairs and had a smoke. And somebody spoke and I went into a dream.
The Beatles, A Day in the Life, from Sgt. Pepper's, released in 1967 and produced by George Martin. I'm Kathy Geary, and you're listening to Now and Then. On today's program, we're honoring the life and the artistry of George Martin. George Martin passed away on March the 8th, 2016. And the New York Times has released a really wonderful article. And they obviously vetted their information, but I read some interesting things in the article from the Times. I had mentioned earlier that when George Martin was hired by EMI for their Parlophone label, it was in 1955. He was only 29 years old, and he was like the youngest man to ever manage a label at EMI. He was working with classical music projects when he joined the staff, the London Baroque Ensemble, with conductors Malcolm Sargent and Charles McCarris. And then he goes from classical orchestra to Pops Orchestra with Sidney Torch and the Queen's Hall Light Orchestra. He did jazz recordings with John Dankworth and Humphrey Lyttelton. And he also did pop music with Matt Monro. And he also did some very unusual comedy recordings with Peter Sellers and the Goons. And he did recordings of a comedy troupe called Beyond the Fringe with Jonathan Miller, Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, and Alan Bennett. Anyway, so anything but rock and roll. And, you know, the story goes that Brian Epstein has a record shop, and someone comes in and asks for this recording by the Beatles. And sure enough, he goes down to the cavern and he starts to investigate them, and he decides he wants to manage them. So Brian Epstein is shopping around some of the early demo recordings of the Beatles in 1962, and he keeps getting turned down. Everybody hears the Beatles and they're just going, no, no, no. And the legend goes that George Martin heard the Beatles and signed them. Well, that's kind of true in a roundabout way. But he initially, when George Martin heard the Beatles demo from Brian Epstein, he turned them down too. That's what it says in the New York Times, so I gotta know they vetted this story. But anyway, here's how the actual contract got signed. You know, one of the things that a record label does is they actually publish sheet music. And there was this guy named Sid Coleman, and he was the director of EMI's publishing division. And he had heard some of the early Lennon and McCartney songs, and he really wanted to publish the sheet music so that they could sell it to other bands. And so the only way they could do that would be to actually sign the Beatles to a recording contract on the Parlophone label. And they had their very, very first recording session with Parlophone on June 6th in 1962. And you know what? George Martin didn't want to go. He just wasn't interested. He assigned it to one of his assistants named Ron Richards. And so in the recording session, this guy Richards decides, you know, this is actually pretty cool. Maybe he should send for George to come. And so he sends for George Martin, and George Martin gets there and he takes over the session. And I guess that was all that it took. One of the first things that George Martin did was to tell them that Pete Best wasn't a good enough drummer and they need to replace him. And that's how Ringo Starr got introduced into the band. They worked on two songs, Love Me Do and Please Please Me. And there's a wonderful video from the Beatles anthology of George Martin talking about working with the Beatles when they first started in 1962. And it also includes some interesting commentary by some of the other Beatles. So I thought it might be fun for us to listen to it here today on the radio show. Here we go. This is George Martin talking about Please Please Me.
Fine material for artists by going to Tin Pan Alley and listening to all the publishers' wares. I mean, that was a regular part of my life. I spent a long time looking for songs. And the songs I was looking for the Beatles was really a hit song. It didn't matter, so long as it suited the group. And Love Me Do, as I say, was the best one they were able to offer. The kind of song I was looking for, I did actually find. And that was a song by Mitch Murray called How Do You Do It? And I was convinced this was a hit song.
How do you do what you do to me? I wish I knew. If I knew
not a great piece of songwriting. You know, it wasn't the most marvellous song I'd ever heard in my life, but I thought it had that essential element which would appeal to a lot of people. And we did record it. John took the lead.
How do you do what you do to me? I wish I knew. If I knew how you do it to me, I'd do it to you.
George said, well, it's a number one song. You want a number one? This is it. We said, yeah, but we cannot go back up to Liverpool singing that. We cannot be seen with that song.
So we'd never issued How Do You Do It? But I did later give it to Joey and the Pacemakers, and it did become number one.
How do you do what you do to me? I wish I knew. If I knew how you do it to me, I'd do it to you.
So George Martin says, well, have you got anything you'd like to do? We said, we've got a song called Please Please Me. This is one John had just written, and it was kind of slow Roy Orbison kind of thing. Come on, jump, jump, come on, please, please me. Big note at the end, just like Orbison.
And I'd heard Roy Orbison doing Only the Lonely or something, and I was trying to please me, that's where that came from. And also, I was always intrigued by the words of please lend your little ears to my please, Bing Crosby song. Mm-hmm. I was always intrigued by the double use of the word please.
And I said, okay, we'll give it a whirl. Let's try your song. Let's see if it works. And we did. And at the end of that session, I was able to say to them, you got your first number one. Great.
Last night I said these words to my girl. I know you never even try, girl.
Let's go back a bit. If you remember, the very first record we issued was Love Me Do. Second record we issued was Please Please Me, which was only arrived at after much doubt on my part whether they could ever write a hit song. From that moment onwards, they blossomed. They became wonderful songwriters. But before they showed evidence of that, I still had to have an album out. And so what I did was, I mean, I'd been up to the Cavern and I'd seen what they could do. I knew their repertoire. I knew what they were able to perform. And I said, let's record every song you got. Come down to the studios and we'll just whistle through them in a day.
Here we go.
You're right. Get this bloody little mic out of the way.
Don't be nervous, John. Don't be nervous.
Take it, Evan.
So how could I dance with another? Oh, and I saw her standing there. The world is treating me bad. Say he loves you more than me, so I will set you free. Go with him. Chains, my baby's got me locked up in chains.
But we knew those songs, you see, because we did, that was the act we did all over the country.
I've been told when a boy kisses a girl, take a trip around the world, hey, hey. Ask me why
I'll say I love you.
please you. Love, love me do. You know I love you.
P.S. I love you.
You, you, you.
'Cause baby, it's you.
Sha la 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 la.
Baby, it's you.
Sha la 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 la.
Basically, this album was just what we did on live, you know, in the clubs. So I think we just kept running through songs. What about this? What about this? How does that go? And we play a bit, and then he said, well, what else have we got?
Listen, do you want to know a secret?
A taste of honey,
tasting much sweeter than boy. There is a place where I can go.
And 10:30 that evening, John finally, about 10 o'clock, he sang Twist and Shout. It's because his voice was going all day and he knew he could only give it sort of one or two goes and it would just rip it, which it did. And you can hear it on the record, but it was a pretty cool performance.
I couldn't sing the damn thing, I was just screaming.
That was a piece from the Beatles anthology with George Martin discussing some of the early work that he did with the Beatles. I'm Kathy Geary, and today's program, we're honoring the life of George Martin. You know, before George Martin became almost as famous as the Beatles themselves, the idea of a record producer was just another function at a record label. It wasn't really like a separate career. And so EMI really did not know what they had. The Beatles did get signed to Parlophone in early 62, and by 1965, they are just fabulously successful. The money is pouring into EMI. But, you know, George Martin didn't get any share of all this incredible financial success. The story is that Brian Epstein originally offered George Martin a share of the publishing. And this man had so much integrity that he turned it down on the grounds that it would be a conflict of interest. That's amazing to me. When you think of the music industry and record labels and everyone taking advantage of the Beatles, there is a man with a kind of a singular integrity and knew who he was. So here's what he did. He goes to EMI and he tells them, you know, you should be paying me a royalty on these recordings instead of a salary, which, let's face it, was probably, you know, a fairly modest salary. And EMI wouldn't go for it. They refused to offer him any more than just a small token bonus. What were they thinking? George Martin leaves the company and he forms his own production company in 1965 in August, called the Associated Independent Recording, AIR, A-I-R. And so, of course, the Beatles insisted that EMI continue to engage Mr. Martin's independent recording company for all of their recordings. So that was an incredible step in defining a record producer, you know, the role of a record producer. He opened his own studio in London in 1970. He opens a studio in the Caribbean on the island of Montserrat, AIR Studios, in 1979. In 1993, George Martin opens another AIR studio in Lyndhurst. It's a Victorian church in London. And he apparently was very active there. He said, George Martin said, I'm there every week. He said that in 2003. I listen to my friends who come and do film recording. I love sitting in a 100-piece orchestra and listening. And I still do a bit of writing, and I help a bit with studio work sometimes. So as a famous producer, you know, he started a genre. You know the name Phil Spector. You know the name Quincy Jones. Well, George Martin was the one who invented that as a career. And when George Martin passed away recently on March the 8th, 2016, Quincy Jones did a Facebook post about George Martin, and he called him, quote, my musical brother who knew the secrets of our craft that so few know today. So, you know, we've talked about the orchestral influence and some of the ideas of song structure and form. And it really seems to me, although I haven't really read anything to support this, that he had a special relationship with Paul McCartney. You know, the orchestral work that he did was on a lot of Paul McCartney's songs. But he also, obviously, worked with John Lennon. And there's a song in 1965 called You've Got to Hide Your Love Away, and it's on the Help album. And it's very unusual because it's a John Lennon song, but there's flutes in that song. And that was George Martin's idea, to add flutes. And apparently John went along with it. It was kind of an unusual suggestion. And it's interesting because they've only got four tracks. So the very first track is the basic rhythm track. And then is George Harrison's guitar with some extra percussion. And then on the third track, which is John Lennon's vocal lead track, because there's just not that many tracks available, George Martin records a tenor flute in the spaces between Lennon's phrases. And then he adds one more additional alto flute part, an octave higher than the first flute part, and it's on the last available track on a four-track machine. So these little touches, you don't really even, they seemed to be such a part of the sound of the Beatles that they just slipped past me. I didn't realize how critical all these details and all this work that George Martin did had so much to do with the sound of the Beatles. Let's listen to You've Got to Hide Your Love Away. This is John Lennon's song from the Beatles album Help in 1965.
Turn my face to the wall. If she's gone, I can't go on. feeling 2 foot small. Everywhere people stare, each and every day. I can see them laugh at me, and I hear them say, hey, you've got to hide your love away. Hey, you've got to hide your love away. How can I even try? I can never win. How could she say to me, love will find a way? Gather round all you clowns, let me hear you say, hey, you've got to hide your love away. Got to hide your love away.
So there's the flute part that George Martin added to John's song, You've Got to Hide Your Love Away. So I mentioned earlier it was unusual because George Martin invited the Beatles into the control room at the Abbey Road Studios, and he shows them all these different recording techniques, changing the speed of the tape and playing tapes backwards. You got to realize that there was no digital production then. It was all cut and paste. In all these interesting four-track sessions. So once he showed them how to play something backwards, here's the quote, George says, from that moment they wanted to do everything backwards. They wanted guitars backwards and drums backwards and everything backwards, and it became a bore. So let's talk about some of these backwards recording. The first session that I'm familiar with that had any backwards recordings on it was the song called Rain. Rain was released in 1966, and in the coda of the song, John Lennon's lead vocal is played backwards and running backwards over the song coda. Well, it's interesting because there's a little bit of a disagreement about how that came about. George Martin recalls this, quote, I was always playing around with tapes, and I thought it might be fun to do something extra with John's voice. So I lifted a bit of his main vocal off the four track, put it on another spool, turned it around, and then slid it back and forth until it fitted. John was out at the time, but when he came back, he was amazed. Well, then John Lennon has a different memory. John Lennon thinks that he created it. Here's what John Lennon said, quote, after we'd done the session on that particular song, it ended at about 4 or 5 in the morning. I went home with the tape to see what else you could do with it, and I was sort of very tired, you know, not knowing what I was doing, and I just happened to put it on my own tape recorder, and it came out backwards. Then I liked it better, so that's how it happened. Well, I don't know, my humble opinion, if I had to choose whose memory might have been less influenced by that time and might have been more in touch with reality, I would probably have to go with George Martin. So let's listen to this backwards vocal recording on the Beatles' Rain. This is from 1966.
Thank you.
And there we have it. That's Rain by the Beatles, with John Lennon's vocals playing backwards over the coda of the song. George Martin had an astounding influence on the Beatles and their careers, but the thing that really seems to be most fascinating for me, besides the way that he influenced the Beatles, was the spark that he woke in Paul McCartney. Because Paul McCartney began composing classical music as early as 1991. And I attribute this to the work that George Martin did with him and introduced him to concepts way beyond what Paul would have been able to achieve without the kind of exposure that he had to orchestral music and techniques. So we're going to hear a little bit of Paul McCartney's Ocean's Kingdom, an instrumental symphonic work. His first foray into classical music, Paul McCartney was commissioned by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in Liverpool to write a composition, and they worked on it for 3 years, and it premiered with the orchestra's 150th anniversary. And it was an oratorio piece. Dame Kiri Takanawa sang the lead. And he's written, he has recorded since that time, 5 orchestral classical compositions. He was commissioned by the New York City Ballet to compose a piece, and it premiered in London in June of 2011, commissioned by the New York City Ballet, orchestral music in 4 movements, and Paul McCartney says, it's a ballet that tells a love story based in 2 fantastic worlds, the pure ocean kingdom and the earth kingdom with its baddies who threaten the underwater way of life. According to Paul McCartney, quote, love happens when earth meets water, and you'll have to see whether the couple make it. It was premiered in New York City at the David Koch Theater on Lincoln Center on September the 22nd in 2011. And the production also features costumes for the dancers, which were designed by his daughter, Stella McCartney. Let's listen to the first movement of Paul McCartney's Ocean's Kingdom. I'm Kathy Geary. You've been listening to Now and Then. Today's program honoring the life and the influence that George Martin had on the Beatles and Paul McCartney as a composer, as a producer, George Martin. I hope you enjoyed the program today. Thank you so much for listening. Support comes from the community and from the River Reporter newspaper in Narrowsburg, New York, riverreporter.com. It's a couple of seconds before 4 p.m. I'm showing 64 sunny golden degrees outside of our studios, and you're tuned to 90.5 FM. This is WD.